Belgic Confession, Article 37, The Last Judgment. Finally, we believe, according to the word of God, when the time appointed by the Lord, which is unknown to all creatures, is come, and the number of the elect complete, that our Lord Jesus Christ will come from heaven, corporally and visibly, as he ascended with great glory and majesty, to declare himself judge of the quick and the dead, burning this old world with fire and flame to cleanse it. Tonight's class will cover two topics. First, Antichrist's miracles, that more briefly, and then Antichrist's will. We begin then by wrapping up our consideration of the Antichrist's miracles. Our last two classes covered especially two points regarding the miracles of the man of sin. First, their reality, that they're not fakes or con jobs. And second, we looked at their instances. And what chapter of Scripture is the only chapter in the Bible that actually specifies the miracles that he's going to do?
Revelation 13.
And that chapter specifies two particular miracles performed by Antichrist in connection with the false prophet. The first, calling down fire from heaven, and the second involves the image of the beast, so that it is given life and speech, and it causes the death of the non-worshippers of the beast. Revelation 13, verse 13 for the first, and verse 15 for the second miraculous work. Now, this is the bit I want to get to. There are two particular antichrists that all this militates against. What we've seen about the antichrist miracles, their reality, and especially their instances, they militate against two views of the Antichrist. Can you name me either of them? The papacy. We're going to treat that one second. The papacy. Anyone come up with the first one? Nero. Antichrist is Nero, according to some. That's the beast, whether individually Nero or the kingdom Rome in Revelation 13, exclusively, in toto. So with this idea of the Antichrist, this identification of the man of sin, there's one particular year that comes to mind. AD 70. We're working with a view of the Antichrist that sees him firmly fixed in the first century AD. And those who hold that Nero is the Antichrist, what's the best word for them as a group? I'm not talking about critical, but how would you describe them?
Preterists.
That's the preterist view of the Antichrist. And the rationale for AD 70, Nero is the Antichrist, is to serve the post-millennial golden age, which they desire, by putting Antichrist and persecution and apostasy, which are closely related to him, into the past, preferably the distant past. And AD 70 is about almost as distant as you could get in the New Testament age. The other view is the Antichrist is the Pope. He is the beast individually in Revelation 13, or his organization is that beast. Antichrist and the papacy. And this one, you don't say, well, that's in connection with AD 70, one particular year with Nero dying soon before it. But papacy, you're talking centuries. Right to the current incumbent, Francis, who's totally heretical according even to, not just to Christianity and the Bible's teaching, but according to historic Roman Catholic teaching. His views are horrendous. Any traditional Roman Catholic should be totally disgusted with Francis the First. So the last 1,500 or so years, depending on when people say the Bishop of Rome became the Pope who became the Antichrist. And this view, Nero is the view of the preterists. The papacy is the view, the papacy as Antichrist is the view of the
Presbyterians.
Historicists, yes. But the best category is the historicist, because not every Presbyterian holds that view, but every historicist holds that view. And that's particularly associated with a way of reading the book of Revelation. So let's look at the specific miracles performed by these two purported antichrists in the light of Revelation 13. Did Nero call down fire from heaven? No. He did a lot of crazy things, but he didn't do that. The image of the beast, Nero or his associate, gave life and speech to a beast so that it became a sort of killing machine, such that it would slaughter those who did not worship Nero. Anyone in your reading of Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, or knowledge of anything to do with that megalomaniac, you know, there's him fiddling when Rome burns and so forth, and he's often attributed as the one who had Peter and Paul martyred. Think of all the things you know about Nero. What miracles did Nero perform, or even claim to perform? Some people said that he never really died, or that he's going to come back again in the future, but calling down fire from heaven, this image of the beast killing machine, or any other miracles, it's just not there. And when I read the Reconstructionist material, I'm thinking, and who hold to Nero, these, I don't even remember them ever dealing with the past, so I looked up some of their books that deal specifically with this. Just, you know, I don't have them all, but the ones I had, none of them even referred to. Well, you wouldn't, would you? Because you're in a hiding to nothing. Gloss it over, here's a weak point, say nothing about it, move on, nothing to see here. Mary?
Well, most of the time we say Revelation isn't literal and we can't take it literally because it's a vision. Couldn't they just say, well, this is a vision, we don't mean this literally, Nero could be, doesn't really do miracles, but could they use that as an argument?
Yes, someone could argue that, you know, why do you take this literally? Well, we take the fire from heaven literally because it literally happened in Job chapter 1. And there is that question, is this literal in the book of Revelation? That is a tricky one. But in that Nero was the Antichrist according to them, and we have the history of Nero, it's incumbent upon them to show us how, let's say it's not literal, but you say that, right? Show us how fire from heaven or the image of the beast fitted something to do with him. Or show us from 2 Thessalonians 2, which Ken Gentry, for instance, takes to refer to Nero. Others say it's a Jewish high priest. When that passage talks about great miracles, signs, and wonders, I mean, what great miracles, signs, and wonders did Nero perform? You know, tell us. So that everybody would believe the lie. I mean, what was the lie? Let's move to the papacy. Are you aware of the papacy or any pope claiming that he has called down fire from heaven? And they claim a load of things, but calling down fire from heaven. Or an image of the beast whereby it's given life and speech and becomes a sort of killing machine, or anything sort of like that that would fit. Because again, to go back to Mary's point, you know, if you're not going to take it literal, and that is a real question, the things in Revelation 13, in that this has been going for 1500 years, you should at least be able to say, well, maybe it's not literal, but it refers to this, and make a convincing case for it. What miracles are claimed by the popes and the Roman Catholic Church?
Mostly concerning images and the stigmata.
Stigmata, okay. When you say images, Julian, what do you mean?
Well, images of Mary weeping and that kind of stuff.
Okay, Mary weeping. And then, of course, there's all sorts of clay and water built in there and temperature. And yeah. The Turin Shroud is a sort of miracle. Healing miracles.
Lourdes.
And then they're connected with certain places like Lourdes. They're connected with the Mass. Sometimes the Mass can be used to perform a miracle, though Rome claims the Mass itself is a miracle. But it's one of those miracles that nobody can actually see. I mean, so what sort of a miracle is that? Mary performs miracles. Miracles involving relics. Miracles, according to the theory of the Church of Rome, are crucial for someone to be canonized or beatified. You need two proven miracles, and then the Church of Rome has a committee that look into them, and then they give a sign of approval. So the papacy has all sorts of miracles, or at least claims them, but none of them come near the two that the Bible actually says that the Antichrist would do. And if you're not going to take it literal, well, what's it like, Mary?
Well, I was just thinking that beatification, I mean, those miracles are only known after they're dead, aren't they?
Mary makes the point that the miracles of those who are canonized or beatified typically come, maybe always, but usually at the very least come after they're dead. I printed out an article from the website, because I was looking into this, what miracles does Rome claim? And here was an interesting one. It's entitled 12 Papal Miracles, an Unscientific Ranking by Sarah Lasco. And when she says an unscientific ranking, she means here they are as my personal favorites. So Pope Fabian the First, here was a miracle. A dove landed upon him, and he was a layman, and that symbolized that this layman should go in straight as Pope in 236. Has anybody here ever had a dove land on them? Pope Urban I prayed in 230, and an idol fell down and killed 22 people. Well, whenever it fell down, I mean, how do you prove that? Pope Pius V prayed that the Vatican, with its European allies, would win a naval battle, the Battle of Lepanto, against the Ottoman Turks in 1571 off the coast of Greece. So he prayed, and then the right side won, his side. And then he announced it before news had gotten back from the battlefield. So he prayed for it, then it happened, and then he announced it before it got back from the battlefield. That's kind of hard to prove. You know, there's a 50-50 chance to... And then you prayed about it, and then maybe he had some very swift messenger that got there first. Maybe he had a carrier pigeon or something with special news, or maybe he just guessed or he had a good feeling about it. I mean, if you're going to count that. Pope Alexander I escaped a well-guarded prison cell. Number 8, this is a countdown, Pope Agapetus I made a paralyzed man walk. John the 23rd killed a dying 23-year-old nun, another healing miracle. She had a gastric hemorrhage, and the relic of the recently deceased Pope was instrumental in it. John Paul II, many of us can remember him, he cured a person with Parkinson's and a brain aneurysm of a lady in Costa Rica. Pope Celestine V, the panel reckoned that he performed 11 real miracles, healing miracles apparently, but they couldn't make up their mind on 7 of them. Did you ever? I mean, you read the Gospels and the Apostles, and and Luke says, we weren't sure about that one. Yeah. Pius X cured a paralyzed child, an Irish girl covered with sores. His sock cured another girl's foot disease. Another was cured of hip disease when the Pope prayed for her, and a child who'd been paralyzed from birth. Cornelius I, his statue blessed the marriage of an unlikely couple. So the devotional statue of Cornelius on the altar then bowed, apparently. I'd like to know if it bowed. Did it actually spring back up again or something like that? And then blessed the couple. We're down to number 2. Pope Gregory II blessed three pieces of bread, and any soldier who bit the piece of bread when they went to battle against the Muslims, it says, those that ate the bread survived the battle with a wound. I didn't have time to research that. I wonder if they mean survived the battle without a wound. And then, of course, you wonder how many bit it. Anyway, and the number one, Pope Clement I, heading underwater tomb revealed by an ebbing sea. I'll read all three lines of this so you get it clear. After Clement I was martyred and thrown into the Black Sea in 101 AD, the waters of the sea receded until they revealed a marble tomb where Clement's body was found in a stone coffin. So they threw him into the sea dead. Then the waters recede and they saw a marble tomb, and there's a stone coffin was in. And then the clincher is the next and final sentence. Every year after, once a year, the sea would recede and reveal the shrine. Timmy's looking skeptical. Well, they're the top 12 papal miracles, unscientifically ranked by Sarah Lasco, and just a sample, of course. But it doesn't tally with anything in Revelation chapter 13. Now, there's another position on the Antichrist that must also be critiqued in the light of Scripture's teaching on Antichrist's miracles. Now, this critique's different. The view we're critiquing here, they speak of a miracle in connection with Antichrist, but they actually misunderstand the passage. The passage doesn't teach the miracle that they think the Antichrist is going to do. So we're back in Revelation 13 again. What was it? Revelation 13, verse 3. Revelation 13, verse 3. I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed. And last time, without explaining positively what it does mean to any great length, we pointed out that the beast here is pictured as having animal parts and amalgamated, and that he has seven heads and with crowns and so on them. And then Revelation 13 verse 3 says, I saw one of his heads. One of his seven heads. The passage is not teaching that the Antichrist will have a head wound that he will recover from. So whose view of the Antichrist then are we contradicting here? The dispensationalist account, because they have an Antichrist in a literal 7-year tribulation, and then he receives a wound which was or should have been fatal to the head. And that's not the point of Revelation 13, verse 3. So, our view of Antichrist with respect to his miracles gives us arguments against three views of the Antichrist written on the board. Number one, Nero. Number two, the papacy. And number three, that of the dispensationalists. Now, the blow to the Antichrist view that we've just been arguing from his miracles, which is the most serious? So that this argument, it's like fire from heaven coming down on their view of Antichrist. Which of the three is the most serious, is the most seriously hit with this argument? And I should warn you that if you've been listening closely and really understanding it, you would know the answer. But I should also point out, to be fair, that some of you have had a long, hard day. And I can see one or two faces out there that look like men who've had a long, hard day. So our arguments, which of these one, you know, sort of, it's like fire from heaven has come down and just destroyed it. If this one, this argument just blows it out of the water, there's nothing left. Mary says Nero. Nero, the preterist view. The miracles that he is said to do, the very fact that he does miracles. I mean, what does Nero do? And then the miracles that are mentioned. How does that fit? The next most serious, the next view that's more seriously damaged than the other one. Number two. Mary says number two, the papacy, and that is the right answer too. They can still claim, well, maybe some future pope or the Roman Church, the people who hold that the pope's the Antichrist, is going to do these specific miracles. The one that's least serious, you know, it's a criticism, it doesn't help their position, it hinders it, but is the dispensationalist, and I think everyone was likely to get that one. You could say that our critique of the dispensationalists, their view is only wounded. You know, they're not wounded to death, but they are wounded, but it's not a fatal blow. Because a dispensationalist could come along and say, you know what, I think you're right. I think that Revelation 13 verse 3 doesn't say that he's actually going to die or have a near-death experience. And you could actually put that to one side and still have their view. Now, I'm not saying their view is right or anything, but I'm just saying from this perspective, their view could we could make this point and they could sort of just sidestep it and then keep their system. Antichrist miracles then, and these are probably the three biggest views among conservative Christians, and it's people who believe that the Bible is infallible. That's what I mean by conservative here. Antichrist miracles fit what we've said about them, that they're real, and the specifications of them, so far as that's known, they fit with the amillennial view of the Antichrist. Because nobody has performed the two miracles of which Revelation 13 speaks, fire from heaven and the wonders involving the image of the beast. Nero didn't in the first century, and the popes in the last 15 centuries or so haven't done it either. The dispensationalists are wrong with their view of an Antichrist that's going to die or almost die. But when we talk about Antichrist and his miracles as being future, fire from heaven, real, like Job 1, and whatever form the image of the beast with the miracles take place there, and then the other miracles, well, that actually fits perfectly well with our view. Now, somebody could say, well, this is all a bit circular. You have your own views. You look at it, you come back, and lo and behold, yours fits. I grant it. But it's not viciously circular or a very small circle. It's a bigger circle, and so has some value. Let's move on from Antichrist's miracles to Antichrist's will. A word of clarification. When I say or speak of Antichrist's will, I am not referring to his last will and testament. That is a document disposing of his earthly goods upon his death. And by the way, no one will be the beneficiary of such a testamentary disposition. If the Antichrist writes a will, no one will actually benefit from it. Because when he dies, that's the end of the world. When we're talking here about Antichrist's will, we're referring to him with respect to his soul or spirit or heart. From the perspective of his faculty of choosing and his activity of willing. The will of Antichrist refers to his desires, his wishes, his wants, his decisions. And now remember, Antichrist's will, as befits the nature of Antichrist himself, it's not the will of a fallen angel. It's not the will of a demon or Satan. It's the will of a man. We established that in great detail in previous classes. It's the will of a totally depraved man. To go further, it is the will of a totally depraved man under the mighty influence of the devil, with that will of that totally depraved man being more influenced by Satan than any other human being in the history of humanity. Now, I'm curious, has anyone here ever read anything or heard a sermon on the will of the Antichrist? No, you haven't. Do you think the will of the Antichrist and books on Antichrist or sermons, do you think it's a topic that's sort of always treated, it's something you always find in there, or often, or usually, or rarely, or never? That's a hard question. You've got to scan all your, and then think, well, how much of the sum total of Antichrist writings and speeches have I ever sampled? I'll give you my assessment. And again, I freely admit that this is not based on an exhaustive analysis, far from it, but I've never seen a treatment of it. And the odd reference to it, the will of Antichrist, is typically, to my mind, it occurs when a person is commenting or preaching on a specific Bible verse that actually mentions it, and then the person that's there in the text, they have to say something about it. This raises a second question, a question which I had before I launched into the subject, and a question which you may well be having, and if you don't, I'm going to make it explicit. How fruitful will it be, do you think, to look at the Bible's teaching on the will of the Antichrist? And this sounds like a multiple choice ABC. Will it be very fruitful? Oh man, we heard about the will of Antichrist. That really lit the subject up for me. Or somewhat fruitful, or a little bit of help, or not at all. So would you leave tonight's class thinking the pastor led us tonight up a total blind alley? I thought that tonight's meeting was a perfect waste of time. And you can be the judge of this, and no doubt you will be the judge of this, because such is our way as human beings. So we're here dealing with something that could be described as fairly virgin territory. And we're going to search out the mind of God in Scripture on the will of the man of sin. So let's begin where we often begin, because I think it's a helpful starting point. In our treatment of the will of the Antichrist, what biblical book or portion has most to say on it? I mean, is it Daniel or 2 Thessalonians 2, a chapter in a book? Or 1 and 2 John, two books, or Revelation? And when I'm talking about the will of Antichrist, I'm involving, for instance, the noun. Does that book refer to the noun will being used of Antichrist, or a type of Antichrist, and his willing or choosing? And perhaps other references to his will from different angles. What would you say? You've got Daniel, 2 Thessalonians 2, 1 and 2 John, and the book of Revelation.
I'm going for Daniel.
Mary's going for Daniel. Any reason, Mary?
Well, there's a couple of times you've mentioned will and the passages we read.
Yes, that was very well noticed, Mary. So let's deal with the main references to the will of Antichrist, here especially presented in forms of types, in the book of Daniel. We'll treat them in chronological order, which is also the order in which they occur in the book, starting with Daniel 5, verse 19. Daniel 5, verse 19. And for the majesty that he gave him, for the majesty that God gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him, whom he would, that's the reference to the will there, whom he would, he slew, and whom he would, he kept alive, and whom he would, he set up, and whom he would, he put down. Who is being spoken of here?
Nebuchadnezzar.
Nebuchadnezzar is being spoken of to whom? Because at this stage, Nebuchadnezzar is dead.
Belshazzar.
Yes, Belshazzar. So here is Daniel, the writing is on the wall. He has been called in by Belshazzar to interpret the writing on the wall put there by the hand. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. And Daniel tells Belshazzar that Nebuchadnezzar, your great predecessor, whom he would he slew, and whom he would he kept alive, and whom he would he set up, and whom he would he put down, which is the opposite of Psalm 75. God's the one ultimately who raises up, and the one who puts down, the one who judges. So Nebuchadnezzar's will is being spoken of here. Nebuchadnezzar was the head of the first of the four anti-Christian kingdoms set forth as such in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. He is himself an anti-Christian ruler and a type of the man of sin. So his will, what he chose or wanted to do, for some people it meant you live and you die. And you get promotion and you poverty. Does that fit with the biblical idea of Antichrist? His will being life or death, promotion or poverty. Verse 19 says that since he had this sovereign, nasty will, people trembled and feared before him. Does that fit? It says all people, nations and languages trembled and feared before him, because this man has the power of my life and my death, my impoverishment or my elevation. And the previous four chapters of the book of Daniel tell us that this was indeed the case. Daniel 1 verse 10, Daniel doesn't want to defile himself with the king's meat. So he approaches the prince of the eunuchs with a proposal. He says to Daniel, verse 10, I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort? Then shall ye make me endanger my head to the king. I'd like to help you, Daniel, but if we change your diet and you begin to fail or grow thin and pale, well, I fear the king, and that would endanger my head. Chapter 2, a very similar position description of Nebuchadnezzar. He sees this dream and he asks the wise man, number one, to tell him what he had dreamt. Number two, to interpret the dream. And he says that if you can't, I'll cut you in pieces and make your houses a dunghill. But if you interpret it rightly to me, I'll give you gifts and rewards and great honor. That's verses 5 and 6. When the men stall for time, Nebuchadnezzar said, I knew fine well that you would try this ploy. Verse 8, he accuses them of preparing lying and corrupt words before me. And in verses 12 and 13, when they protest again, the king is very angry and very furious, and he commands to kill all the wise men of Babylon and sends out a decree, because his will is sovereign, and when he doesn't get his way, he takes it rather ill. Chapter 3, verse 13, is another instance of this. Nebuchadnezzar has been told about three young Hebrew men who will not worship his golden image. Daniel 3, verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Verse 19, after they make the good confession that such would be idolatry to acquiesce in the king's demand, then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against the three men, so he commanded them to heat the furnace seven times more than it was usually heated. He brooks no opposition to his sovereign will, and he loses his temper when people don't immediately fall into line. Chapter 4, verse 30. Daniel has warned Nebuchadnezzar, when interpreting his dream, that if he becomes arrogant, he will suffer boanthropy, a mental problem whereby he thinks he's a cow. Time lapses. The king speaks and says, "Is this not great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty?" So here's his will being allied with pride. He's strong-willed in his sinful pride. Let's move to chapter 8, verse 4. Chapter 8, verse 4, and the question is, of course, of whom are these things spoken? Chapter 8, verse 4, "I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beasts might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will and became great." This is the will of, according to verse 4. In verse 4, it's said to be the will of what beast? The ram. And according to Daniel 8, what does the ram speak of? Verse 20, "The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia." And I think that was the reason why you struggled with that one. It's not an individual, it's a kingdom. So in Daniel 5, verse 19, we have Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon, the first kingdom. Here we have the ram, which is Medo-Persia, the second kingdom. And the will here of the second of the four kingdoms mentioned in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7, the will of the ram here, the Medo-Persian kingdom, is to do what?
Conquer.
To will is to conquer. To conquer, and so to build an empire and become great. And it says, he did according to his will. This corresponds, this is what I want to do, and then I do it. And does this fit regarding Antichrist and his worldwide kingdom, that he wills to rule the world? Chapter 11, verse 3. And now to go back to Mary's point made earlier, you see why we just read little bits of Daniel 11. We couldn't read the whole chapter. It's 45 verses. That's 3 pages in my Bible. Revelation 11, verse 3. "And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will." Looking at verse 3 in the light of verse 2 and verse 4, who are we referring to in this verse?
I think it's Alexander again.
Julian says it's Alexander the Great. And that is indeed true. And with Alexander the Great, he was the son of Philip of Macedon. He builds up the kingdom of Macedon, the Greek empire, and his is the third anti-Christian kingdom. So Nebuchadnezzar, that's Babylon, Medes and the Persians, of course, that's the second kingdom. Alexander the Great, that's Greece. Possibly the most famous thing about Alexander the Great, besides the fact that he was trained by Aristotle, philosophers always note that point, but was his military genius. He founded a vast kingdom, and he built it up very, very quickly. And he and Napoleon are two of the top contenders, if not one and two, for the greatest generals ever. His will, as presented in Daniel 11, verse 3, and everything we know about him, his will is to conquer and rule. "A mighty king shall stand up or arise," from the Greeks, verse 2 says, and he will rule with great dominion and do according to his will. Chapter 11, verse 16 is our next one. Chapter 11, verse 16. He that cometh against him shall do according to his own will. There's the will, and he does what he wills. He that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, the land of Israel, which by his hand shall be consumed. Who is this speaking of? I'm going to answer this one myself because that will be, an unfair question. This is a reference to Antiochus III, called the Great. His dates are 223 to 187, the date of his rule. He comes to the throne about 100 years after the death of Alexander the Great. He's based, Antiochus III, in Antioch of Syria, and he's a ruler of one of the four kingdoms of the Greeks after Alexander the Great died. At his death, his four generals carved up his vast kingdom and ruled over it. Then they clashed among themselves and the boundaries moved somewhat. Verse 16, we're all getting used to the pattern here. His will in verse 16, very similar. His will is to fight and to reign, including in Israel. And our last reference, the fifth and final text, as we've worked our way through Daniel biblically and chronologically, is Daniel 11, verse 36. In many ways, the most revealing text, and Lord willing, we'll deal with more of this verse next week. Daniel 11, verse 36, and the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that that is determined shall be done. Of whom writes the prophet? Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. That way I'm sure that I've got the spelling right. Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth, who is a great type of Antichrist and the last Old Testament type of Antichrist. And here his will is connected with the usual themes: victory and reign. He wants and desires to become great in the eyes of man. And this is where the pride is even emphasized, as with Nebuchadnezzar. The king shall do according to his will, including persecuting the church, the previous verses, and magnify himself against every god and speak marvelous things against the God of gods. So he'll become great in his own estimation, stuffed full of pride, pride even to the extent of self-deification and putting down all the other gods. Verse 37 speaks of that. Then verse 38 talks about another sort of a god that he sort of worships. So we're dealing here with the will of Antichrist, and our last section concerns analysis of it all, trying to tie together the meaning of these texts. I would say the teaching of the Bible on the will of Antichrist, which is focused in the book of Daniel — Daniel tells us more about it than any of the other books — is that he has a resolute will. He has a resolute will. And a resolute will that is sinful from top to bottom. And this is what we saw from what it taught about the kingdoms of Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. And these individual rulers of the kingdoms, Nebuchadnezzar, Alexander the Great, Antiochus the Third, and Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. Now, when I think of the Old Testament, and especially the Old Testament narratives outside the book of Daniel, there's one figure whose resolute will seems to me is the firmest. He had so many chances to climb down, to change his opinion, to listen to other voices out there, to see sense.
Pharaoh.
Pharaoh said he won't let Israel go. And then God sent nine plagues, and devastated the country, and he still won't let Israel go. Then comes the tenth one, he snaps, and then his will springs the opposite one. Not only now, I'm going to show that I'm powerful, I'm going to push you out. Get out, all of you, immediately, this very night. And then his will snaps back into the original position. He realizes he's lost slaves, so he chases after them. And he's so resolute and determined that even though he sees that Moses has opened up the Red Sea and that this is a potential trap, you can understand a mouse going for cheese because he doesn't really understand the mechanism, but you would have thought a man who is clever enough to rule Egypt, possibly the most powerful kingdom on the earth, would have realized that this had certain dangers. But he was so willing, he was so resolute in his willing that he kept choosing the wicked, wrong, selfish thing, even when an ordinary, totally depraved person would have seen through it all. Are you familiar with the phrase, the will to power? The will to power. Anyone come across? I'm just curious about everything else. In a previous class on the Antichrist, we referred to Friedrich Nietzsche, a philosopher that stands behind much of Nazi thinking, 1844 to 1900. We mentioned his book, The Antichrist. He liked to shock. Sort of like the Tracy Emmons of the in the painting world. Nietzsche is the philosopher who likes to shock and appall Christians. And of course he went stone raving mad under the judgment of God. But he not only wrote The Antichrist, but he coined a phrase in the development of a concept, the will to power. And he said that the will to power is the main driving force in human beings. That's what makes people tick. They want to dominate and rule. And he said this not at all critically. He thought this is the way it should be. That was why he despised Christianity. The meek shall inherit the earth. That shows that these people are losers. He approved of this massively. But it's interesting that this demented philosopher who wrote The Antichrist and come up with the theme of the will to power, that idea of the will to power as explaining human beings, or at least some human beings, and especially certain particular human beings, really explains the perspective on the Antichrist in the book of Daniel, the will to power. Out of all the people who will to have power, to exercise it, and to rule it, I mean, he is number one. He has the largest will over the largest sphere, and he has the strongest will. The will to power. And Nietzsche wanted an anti-Christian ruler. He wanted the overthrow of all Christians. And it's interesting that he, because of his own depravity and logical thinking, pursuing an idea to the end, actually summed up in that little phrase what the Antichrist is all about. An insight from one of the church's most wicked philosophical enemies. Let's move now to the Antichrist with his resolute will and bring in the devil. Bringing in the devil. There is a verse in the Old Testament which speaks of the Antichrist's will that is the outstanding one in my thinking. I'm curious if anyone has the same opinion or if any particular text appeals to you in this regard. Julian?
Isaiah 14:14.
Yes, Isaiah 14 verse 14. And which makes it easy to remember, the two 14s, and then we'll include the previous verse. Verse 12, we'll go back a verse further, refers to Satan. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? Verse 13, dealing with Babylon and seeing behind him the evil spirit. For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. And that's the devil's desire. And in the person through whom he works most fully has that evil desire and has it most resolutely. And then he's empowered to actually fulfill his desire. And 2 Thessalonians 2 and Revelation 13 talk about Satan's working in him, which is to say through his intellect and will, and through his body and speech, because that's how human beings operate in connection with the way God has made us, our constitutive parts. Let's turn now to Colossians chapter 2. Colossians 2, the last verse of the second chapter of Colossians. Colossians 2, 23, referring to the strange and idolatrous philosophy that was swirling around. Paul's critique includes this line, which things have indeed a show of wisdom in will worship and humility and neglecting of the body, not in honour to the satisfying of the flesh. He brings out various elements in corrupt, unbiblical worship and why they're attractive to people and deceptive and fool people. But he calls the whole package will worship. So there's that concept, will worship. The worship of God as determined by the will, the carnal will of man, which is something that always plays out in the churches, plays out in the human heart, and then corporately in congregations and denominations in the way of apostasy. But our point here on our present subject is that Antichrist, with his will, and he had a very strong will, you wonder how his mother would have trained him as a very strong-willed child who would have needed a fair bit of corporal discipline. Maybe that's part of the problem. He never got it when he was a lad. Will worship. He has a strong will, and it promotes will worship, his own will, so that people sinfully will worship him. My will is supreme, that's the Antichrist, and my will is to corrupt the worship of God so that I am worshipped as God. I alone am worshipped as God. As 2 Thessalonians 2 says, verse 4, he opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sits in the temple of God, the church, even claiming to Christians, so-called, that he himself is God. So will worship, an apostate will worship, and modern worship, and disco worship in churches, it will all find its culmination in the worshipping of the man of sin, and the churches which can't even stand for the second commandment in their worship. I mean, this is where they will end up. And Antichrist said that he will be worshipped as God. He will be worshipped as God alone. That's 2 Thessalonians 2. That's his will, and he is a way of enforcing his own will. And not only will he be worshipped alone, but otherwise, his will is that if you don't worship me alone, then death. Revelation chapter 13. Like Daniel chapter 3 and Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar willed that everybody worship the golden image that he had set up. And the man of sin says, you've got to worship the image set up of me. And if you don't, well, there are penalties. Now, it is striking, and saying all this about the man of sin's will, that it's resolute, that it's empowered by the devil, that it brings to its highest culmination will worship, and even that will of Antichrist sort of makes the world go round. It's realized globally in his kingdom. And yet, God's will is supreme. And by God's will, we mean the will of decree, which always takes place And he's working through Antichrist and his evil will in his providence. And even the will of God's command that ought to be done in this life and that will be enforced in its sanctions at the last judgment and the infliction of everlasting punishment in hell. And we've been looking at the will of Antichrist in the book of Daniel. And the book of Daniel makes it really, really clear that it's the will of God that counts. And this was a lesson that God taught Nebuchadnezzar. Can you think of a chapter out of the 12 where God teaches Nebuchadnezzar that it's not his will, it's somebody else's will that rules the universe?
Chapter 4, but I have a question, because all the Antichrists, are egoists, they're wanting power and all this, and they would never even say they're going to worship God, the very opposite. And yet Nebuchadnezzar, we don't believe he was a believer, but the things he said at the end of chapter 4, I praise and extol the King of Heaven, you don't even expect that from a type of Antichrist.
But Antichrist himself will say the same thing. Let's look at the things that he says. Daniel 4, there are four verses. Four verses in Daniel 4, which talks about the will of God. Daniel 4, verse 17. This matter is by the decree of the watchers, angels who oversee under the providence of God, and by the demand of the word of the holy ones, the saints, the angels, to the intent, this is the goal of it all, that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and not you, Nebuchadnezzar, and that he, the Most High, giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basest of men, like you, Nebuchadnezzar. Everyone's got to know this. And of course, then how does everyone know this? Well, God afflicted Nebuchadnezzar, so that Nebuchadnezzar thought he was a cow, probably a bull, I suppose, a male cow, if he could even remember his gender. Verse 25 says, another repetition of the same, at the end, thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over thee till thou know. So verse 17, the living may know, other people, but now until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, and he gives it to whom he will. And verse 32 repeats that. And what happens is that God drives this man stark, raving, barking mad, although cows don't bark, but you know the point, and then gets him to confess, when he finally degrades him, that he was a proud fool and that God reigns. And that's the confession at the end of Daniel 4 to which Julian was referring. And it contains this line, verse 35, all the inhabitants of the earth are reported as nothing, including me, Nebuchadnezzar, and this great kingdom that I've been boasting about. And he, God, doeth according to his will in the army of heaven, up above, and among the inhabitants of the earth, below. And none can stay his hand, nobody can stop him doing what he wants to do, or say unto him, what doest thou? You can't even question him for doing what he does. And the lesson of this is not that God's going to convert Antichrist, or maybe this man was saved or something like that. It's a theodicy. Here's this type of Antichrist, and God will, just as God brought that man to his knees so that he confessed the truth, to quote Philippians chapter 2, every knee shall bow on the last day, including the knees of Antichrist. Every knee will bow, and every tongue will confess, including Antichrist with the mouth that blasphemed, so forth, that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. And that's the point. The point of that passage isn't, well, God can save anybody. If he can save Nebuchadnezzar, he can save your next door neighbor who blasphemes, takes God's name in vain. There are loads of passages that teach that type of thing. But this passage teaches that even the beast, the man of sin, will bow. And then we should quote verse 21 here. Nebuchadnezzar, the instance of Nebuchadnezzar is brought to the attention of Belshazzar in Daniel 5. Look, There's that writing on the wall. Didn't you learn the lesson? Didn't you see what happened? Your predecessor, Nebuchadnezzar, he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was made with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew and confessed that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointeth over it whomsoever he will. And so the book of Daniel then explains that it's the will of God, in spite of all these, and even through all these anti-Christian kingdoms and anti-Christian rulers, for the victory of the kingdom of God. That's especially Daniel 2, the stone that smashes the image of man, and that stone fills the whole earth in the Catholic Church. It's the victory of the Son of Man who comes in the clouds of heaven. What chapter of Daniel is that?
Seven.
Daniel 7. It is the victory of the cross. And what's the best chapter in Daniel that speaks about the cross? Know your Daniel. Dare to be a Daniel, and also know your Daniel. Daniel 9, verse 24. Speaking of the cross, the prophet writes, as Gabriel spoke, to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness, even the righteousness of God, and to seal up the vision of prophecy and to anoint the Most Holy. And Daniel also speaks about the destruction of Antichrist. There's a verse that's particularly good on that one. I'm referring to Daniel 7, verse 11. I beheld, to continue to pick it up halfway through the verse, I beheld even till the beast was slain. That's interesting. There's a little horn, as he's called a verse before, and then he's called the beast. Think of the book of Revelation. I beheld till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. Like Revelation 19, verse 20, cast into the lake of fire. And then Daniel 12 talks about the great day of resurrection and the final judgment, with people being punished for their sins and others being rewarded and shining as the stars forever and ever. And that's the will of God over the will of Antichrist and the beast. Two last points. The first one is, and I'm not looking for praise here, I'll make that emphatic. Did you think, considering the will of Antichrist was fruitful, worth looking at, beneficial? Good, good. And then the second thing is, having dealt with Antichrist's will, it's useful in itself, but having dealt with Antichrist's will, that is a natural point of entry into looking at Antichrist's intellect, because people are often spoken, especially in Reformed theology historically, as consisting of will and intellect. Intellect to think, will to choose. And then we're going to see what Antichrist does with his intellect, the roles he occupies, how he advances the cause of the kingdom of darkness.